Well, Mr. President, it says a lot when you get applause in this room before we've even started the program. I'm Strobe Talbott, and it is my distinct pleasure to welcome all of you here today. And it's a particular pleasure to be able to welcome my friend of 41 years, my boss for 8 of those years when he was the leader of our nation. And as everyone here knows, he was much more than just the leader of our nation. The scope of his leadership was international. Bill Clinton devoted his presidency, and he is now devoting his post-presidency to what my colleague Kamal Dervish has called in the title of his book, A Better Globalization. And that is what the Clinton Global Initiative is all about. Now in its 5th year, CGI and its members have made commitments valued at $46 billion, impacting 200 million people around the planet. And the purpose has been to advance the struggle against poverty, disease, malnutrition, and more generally, the wretchedness that besets too much of humanity. Brookings's commitment to these development goals and others is personified by Kamal Dervish, until recently the head of the United Nations Development Program and now the director of the Global Economy and Development Program here at the institution. And Kamal will now moderate a discussion on how the private sector can do good even as it does well and even in the toughest of economic times. So Kamal, over to you, and thanks again to all of you for being here.
Thank you very much, Strobe, for starting us off, and thank you so much to this wonderful panel, to President Clinton, to Muhtar Kent, and to Patricia for being here. At a time when the world economy is still in big trouble, there are some signs of improvement. I would never have thought that the oil price passing $60 would be greeted with optimism as good news that shows us where we're at. But I won't take much time. The panel is led by President Clinton. Of course, obviously, he does need no introduction. But I'm just going to remind the audience of one thing. The 22 million jobs were created during his presidency. And that's something these days we perhaps need more than anything else. Maybe one more thing, I also have witnessed while I was at UNDP, his wonderful work post-tsunami, and also his commitment to the climate change issue, and his strong belief that we can do good on climate change while making the economy grow. That this is not a lose-lose situation, but it's a win-win situation. But anyway, that's maybe a topic for some other day. We have Patricia Wirtz, the chairman and CEO of Archer Daniels Midland, the largest agricultural processor in the world. And of course, agriculture, food security is at the center of our concerns. It kind of disappeared a little bit from the headlines, but we should remember that the food situation remains a big challenge, that about 100 million more people are now in poverty because of the economic crisis, that there are major nutrition problems, particularly for early childhood phase of life, which have devastating impact on people throughout their lives. And we have Muhtar Kent, my friend and the CEO and chairman of Coca-Cola, a company, a diversified company, very much also in the area of food, but much more diversified than that, a leader in his field, and also a countryman of mine from Turkey, which I'm particularly happy to say. So without taking more time, I'd ask President Clinton to kick off the discussion.
Thank you, Kamal. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there could hardly be any better evidence of the benefits of the interdependent world and the changes. Is we're having a panel at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and half the people on the stage are Turks. And I doubt that any Greek American resents it. So That's a very good thing. And I'd like to just very briefly, because I'd rather hear from Muhtar and Patricia, but I want to put this into some context. When I started the Clinton Global Initiative, we're about to have our fifth meeting, people said, well, you know, companies are making a lot of money and they ought to be a part of this now. But when times go down, all you'll have are the philanthropists, the foundations, and the NGOs. And I made the argument that the 21st century would be dominated by unusual public-private partnerships that involved government and business and the NGOs working together to deal with a lot of these challenges, and that it made good business sense to do so. So let me try to make the context argument. If there were no economic problems in America and the world, it remains the fact that we are less than 5% of the world's population, and we have, in any given year, depending on how everybody else is doing, between 23 and 25% of the world's GDP. Therefore, if we want to keep our prosperity, we've got to sell something to somebody else, and we have to keep incomes rising in America so that our people are good for business, so they can be customers. You can't have a business without customers. Second point, before the economic collapse occasioned by what happened at Lehman Brothers and the government's decision not to help them, before that, two-thirds of the American people were worse off in inflation-adjusted dollars than they were the day I left office. Their incomes were lower. And most of our economic growth in this decade had come from housing, finance, and consumer spending, which increasingly led to second mortgages on homes and maxed out credit cards. So you had real income and consumption capacity problems in America. Big story in the paper today about people with big student loan debts now think that student loans ought to be covered by the bankruptcy law, which they're not. It was a huge problem for any of this financial collapse. Third context issue. If you believe in free markets and you think they should have a wider range and you want them to do well, you have to deal with the three major constraints on those markets in the 21st century world. One is persistent and growing inequality. I alluded to that, both within the United States and in the larger world. Now, trade and production has lifted more people out of poverty in the last 20 years than at any previous time in human history. China is Exhibit A. The fact that India has the world's largest middle class is Exhibit B. But the population is growing fastest in countries that are poorest and least able to take care of their people. And that's why there's a lot of anti-globalization feeling, because whenever you change the economic model, there's always a concentration of wealth and a lot of people get rich in a hurry. And the system has not been able to keep up with the population growth. And so more and more people around the world are falling further behind. So there's persistent inequality. And inequality has increased in this country ever since we went off the gold standard and got into the international financial institutions. It started, the baseline year is 1973. It increased in every year since 1973, except the 4 years of my second term, when income inequality decreased and the bottom 20% incomes grew faster than the upper 20%, solely because the labor markets were so tight as we moved north of 22 million jobs, and because we had certain supports for workers at the lower end of the scales. And then it resumed again in this decade. So inequality is a huge problem, and it's manifest in incomes, economic opportunities generally, education and healthcare. Second problem the world has is that its interdependence is totally unstable, which has enormous economic consequences. Most recent example, obviously, is not the financial crisis, which is purely interdependent, right? People start looking at the bank book and the housing loans in the UK and Ireland after we cratered. And then Iceland, which had been the crown jewel of European entrepreneurialism, has the highest percentage of self-made millionaires of any country in Europe, winds up also having banks that had done things that cratered the pension funds of police departments in tiny English towns. And the Chinese, which didn't have cash problems, they had $2 trillion in the bank, all of a sudden wound up with 35 million unemployed factory workers. So the interdependence of the world forces us to think about these larger issues. And it goes beyond that, right? A couple of people get swine flu in Mexico, they close the Fort Worth school district. And my neighbors in Chappaqua come up to me and they hear one case in New York and say, ask if they can go to New York City and go to the play. So it's an interdependent world. And finally, the model we have is unsustainable. Unless you think all these climate change people are crazy, we're either going to do something serious about this or we're going to relocate somewhere between 1 and 200 million people in the next four decades at enormous cost and disruption, because they're not going to be able to live where they are now. So my view is this is good business. And in the short run, I don't ever ask anybody to do anything that's not good business. That's my last point. I just went to Stockholm to a big European climate change meeting. Wangari Maathai spoke. She was wonderful. Tony Blair spoke. He was terrific. I got up and said, they were wonderful. I have nothing to add to what they said. Everything they said is right. I came all the way from America to tell you that if you don't have a vote at Copenhagen and you don't have a vote in your local parliament, please don't go to another one of these meetings. You're wasting your time. Go home and do something to prove that it's good economics to save the planet for our grandchildren. If we can do that, we'll get a good agreement in America. We can persuade India and China to join. We can get the world going in the right direction. If we don't, we won't. And we're not going to do that without the heavy involvement of the business community. So that's the context for this discussion from my point of view. I don't think a responsible business can avoid trying to improve the environment in which it operates and the future that the people who will succeed these two fine executives will occupy.
Thank you very much, President Clinton. Sustainability, responsibility, interdependence. Patricia, in these difficult times, particularly also from the point of view of agriculture and food processing, what can be done? What are you doing good while doing well?
Well, thank you for the question, and thank you for the context, President Clinton. In listening to your contextual setting of the stage here, it helps me frame the answer a little bit. At Archer Daniels Midland, we are a large agricultural processor who takes crops from everywhere around the world, wheat and cocoa and corn and oil seeds, and transport and transform them through lots of plants and trying to get them to markets. Now you ask about social investment or social responsibility. We think absolutely, as President Clinton mentioned, that it's critical not only to our business, but to the longer term survival and even thriving of a company like ours, of an industry like ours, to think about social investment being a critical part of its business strategy. It is not separate, it is not just philanthropy, it is not just giving, it is a critical part of the strategy in the longer term. And one of the things we thought about today, we are doing this year, but I thought I'd make today an opportunity to announce it, but we have are announcing today a new ADM Cares program, which has three key components: strong roots, strong communities, and strong bonds. And it's the roots area, and maybe even the communities area, I'd like to talk about a bit. It will devote 1% of pre-tax earnings annually, and the Strong Roots program will try to invest in areas that have high impact and high linkage to where ADM meets the farm, meets the agriculture, meets the areas of need, particularly with respect to agricultural areas who do not have high efficiency, who do not have infrastructure, who are struggling with the aspect of agriculture that is about sustaining the planet and doing so efficiently, sustainably, and with long-term goals in mind. So our commitment to that, we think, is critical, again, for the longer term. A couple of quick examples of strong communities would be where we live and work. We feel it's very important to have long-term commitments there. And strong bonds have to do with our employees, our colleagues, our contractors we work with. We have a giving council we've created to allow those individuals, a giving council to allow where some of that investment goes, as it is colleague-to-colleague giving, disaster relief, et cetera. So the program, we think, will have lots of legs in the long term and will definitely be linked to the areas of agriculture that are important to our industry. One other thing I might mention does have to do with infrastructure. If you think about the areas of poverty or the areas of the world that are somewhat underdeveloped but do rely on subsistence farming today, to advance that to the next level of efficiency and protecting what is actually grown, what harvest is actually grown, the United Nations estimates that 50% of agriculture today is actually left on the ground in waste because people do not have storage or they do not have transportation or linkage to markets. If the ability of agriculture in the long term is to help people be more efficient while protecting the planet, while being more efficient with fertilizer, with agronomic practices, and getting that harvest to market, again, the connection with the capital markets, we think the potential is almost unlimited.
Thank you very much, Patricia. I noticed that you said long-term four times. And I think that's important because some of the short-termism of some sectors in business, I think, is partly responsible for some of the troubles we're having. So saying long-term four times and showing how your business is really focusing on long-term sustainable development, I think, was critical. Mukhtar, you are active all over the world. You're creating value chains. You have been a leader in social responsibility. How have the last 2 years affected you? How are you dealing with the difficulties of the crisis while developing further the kind of model you've been working on?
Thank you. First, it's a great honor and pleasure to be on this panel with President Clinton and yourself, Kemal, and Patricia Wirtz. And thank you for starting your question by saying, what are we doing in the crisis? I think we certainly, no one is immune from this crisis. I always say, no person, no country, no company is immune. Some are more resistant than others, and one of the advantages that we see that we have in the world is that we operate in 203 countries around the world. And the meaning of operate for us is not sell our products, but we produce our products, we distribute our products, and we sell our products in 203 countries around the world. And therefore, we have a philosophy that says that unless we can meaningfully help create sustainable communities in all of those 203 countries where we operate, then we will not have a long-term and sustainable business. And it's a very simple philosophy. 3 days ago was our 103rd birthday, and we intend to be around for many hundred years, and you cannot be around for many hundred years if you can't truly look at sustainability as a key part of your business as opposed to a cost. And we've selected a number of platforms, water being one of them. And we see ourselves having a role of not just, of course, ensuring that we reduce our own water usage, but work with companies like Patricia's company to ensure that down the supply chain we can also create awareness and ensure that we can meaningfully play a role in ensuring that water is treated as a resource as opposed to something that really you just use without thinking. Over the last 5 years, we have reduced our water usage by 20% globally. We use about 300 billion liters of water a year. And we've reduced our water usage by 20% in the last 5 years. We've reduced our water usage. We are going to reduce our water usage by another 20% over the next 5 years, including as the base of last year. And by 2020, we said we are going to be water neutral in the world. What that means is for every 1 liter that we take out for our business, we will give back that 1 liter by 2020. And that's part of the all the commitments we've publicly made with ourselves and our 300 partners around the world, our bottling partners around the world. But that it doesn't stop there, because what we use as water globally is about half the water that Mexico City uses in a year, what we use. The issue is really, it goes down to agriculture, as Patricia knows very well, because for 1 kilogram of rice, you need 5,000 liters of water. And we've started working with growers of sugarcane around the world, Better Sugarcane Initiative, and we've got a number of other initiatives around the world where we've started projects, A, to raise awareness, and B, to ensure that we can make a meaningful difference. And President Clinton used the word interdependency. 5-6 years ago, when I was at Davos, for the first time, this notion came up. Government, civil society, and business are interdependent and have to come together. And at that time, I thought, that's a funny concept. Today, it is an integral part of how we need to solve some of the issues like water in the world. Because unless government, business, and civil society can come together meaningfully and create specific programs, then this cannot be solved down the supply chain. And I'll give you an example. We and the World Wildlife Fund have formed a partnership where we're working with individual governments around the world to reinvigorate 7 river basins around the world, river basins like the Yangtze, the Danube, Rio Grande, etc., 7 river basins around the world, and where we have announced programs in Africa recently, jointly with World Wildlife Fund, to generate clean water initially for 3 million people with the RAIN initiative, which is Replenish Africa initiative, and make sure that we can, as we do it, we can multiply our efforts through awareness-raising programs. So I just want to sort of end there. We've got other initiatives around carbon footprint, because, again, it makes good business sense. All our trucks are being converted into hybrid vehicles, and we're talking about we have more trucks than in the world than UPS and DHL and FedEx put together. So we do need to make sure that our trucks are all converted. We have a program over the next few years. And also we install and commission millions and millions of pieces of refrigerated equipment around the world. We currently own 10 million inside 20 million customers. Pieces of refrigerated equipment, and again, with Greenpeace, of all NGOs, Greenpeace and Coca-Cola have made a partnership around the world to convert our refrigerated equipment into HFC-free units, and we're already installing 100,000 of those as we speak. So interdependency, again, is the key, where and if you thought 10 years ago Greenpeace and Coca-Cola are going to come together for this initiative, I think people would have said that you're part of Flat Earth Society.
Thank you very much, Muhtar. And you gave us a lot of very concrete examples. I think the water neutrality by 2020 is a fantastic target. And it's hard to believe it can be done, but I'm sure you will do it. And at the same time, you also reminded us that cities, governments have to be important players in all that, with the comparison to Mexico City. President Clinton, I think you founded CGI about 5 years ago, a little more than 5 years ago. How have you seen attitudes evolve? I mean, you have championed these partnerships between business, policymakers, public sector, and civil society. And if you look back the last 5 years, compared to where we were at and where you were at 5 years ago to now, how would you characterize it?
Well, one thing that was interesting to me, last year we had the meeting right after the Lehman Brothers collapse, and we still had big participation. And when you were kind enough to or Strobe was kind enough to say in his introduction, which was, by the way, ridiculously favorable, but illustrates Clinton's third law of politics. Whenever possible, be introduced by someone you appointed to high positions. But anyway, when we, it is true that we have $46 billion worth of commitments over, they'll play out over a 10-year period, but, and they have already touched 200 million lives. But that slightly overstates the case because the energy commitments are extremely capital intensive. Nonetheless, there have been a lot. What I have seen is that when people showed up in the beginning, they were interested, and we quickly found out, and for those of you interested, Bob Harrison, who runs our Clinton Global Initiative, is here. But we have a full-time commitments office, because the unique thing we had was, we said, we got a real deal for you. This is going to be shorter and cheaper in Davos, but you have to make a commitment or you can never come back. And besides that, we're giving you the joy of driving in New York City at the opening of the UN. And I had no idea if it would work, but it turned out people were interested in it. But we had this, what I have seen is, so we set up a full-time commitment office, and when people know they're coming to CGI and they have money but they don't know what they want to spend it on, or they're an NGO and they got a good idea but they don't know how they're going to fund it, or they want partners and they don't know where to find them, we do that year-round, both before and after CGI, so everyone can make and keep their commitments. And we never have more than two or three people who can't come back the next year. Most of them just sort of wanted to see what it was like, and that's fine. But the people that come year in and year out are people that have honored their commitments every year. What I found was that more and more people got into their commitments, began to spend more time on it, and over time, more of them were involved in partnerships. For example, Coca-Cola's been active at CGI, and they very rarely do something on their own now. It's really interesting. They're always looking for how they can put together four or five or six partnerships. Last year, we had seven or eight different groups commit $130 million total to help Haiti rebuild after their hurricanes. $130 million in Haiti is one heck of a lot of money. And it covered a whole range of things. So that's what I've seen, a growing cooperation and sophistication. If I could just say one other thing, Muhtar, because I don't know whether I'll get another chance. I want to say something about what both of them said. First of all, Coca-Cola's commitments that I know about illustrate how important the quality and willingness of government is in some of these areas. And it's very important if you get into this business of sustainability and all the things Patricia talked about. You have to ask yourself, what can I do that's 100% within my control? And what can I do that I have to have a government with capacity and commitment in? What can I do cheaper, faster, better if I work through an NGO? And government should ask the same question. So, for example, their biggest reforestation commitment is in Mexico. For a simple reason. President Calderon responded to the United Nations call for a billion new trees by saying, put me down for 25%. And he's got a map of Mexico he'll be only too happy to show you that shows this wide swath where he's going to have 250 million trees. So it made sense if you operate in every country in the world and you want to contribute to the fight against global warming as well as to restoring watersheds and water quality, if you're going to do a reforestation project, do it someplace where you know that there's a competent, committed government that will have an impact. Second thing I want to say is you didn't mention what I consider to be your most important domestic social responsibility, which is that Coca-Cola and PepsiCo got all the beverage companies together and made an agreement with our Alliance for a Healthier Generation to fight childhood obesity, and they have reduced the caloric content of beverages and vending machines in schools in this country by 58% in 3 years. And that's very important. Now you say, they must be losing money on that. Well, it depends on whether you take the long view or not, because that's what you talked about. If we had a 9-year-old child in Harlem diagnosed with type 2 diabetes 3 years ago, we were at risk of having the first generation of Americans to live shorter lives than their parents. if you really want a healthy customer base, it's okay if you sell smaller drinks in schools and healthier ones to have healthier adult customers 10 years down the road. So I want to thank them. The important thing she talked about, that I love that a company like ADM would talk about the need for sustainable agriculture. You know, back in the 70s when we got crazed with the prospect of exporting our food, both processed and just row crops, basically wheat, rice, and soybeans, and other people were too, the bottom fell out of global support in rich countries for sustainable agriculture in poor countries. And by 1981, it became virtually non-existent. Bob Zelick, bless his heart, is the first World Bank president to stand up and say this was a terrible mistake. But he does not have the money he needs. I work in Ethiopia with my AIDS project. Two summers ago when I was over there, and if you get sick in Addis, you're fine. But 60% of the people live in villages of 1,000 or less. And they only have, so they have 1,000 villages. They only have 700 clinics in the whole country. So I had to get out around the country to see what we were doing on that. They had a bumper crop. By the winter, they had a famine in the Horn of Africa. They didn't need a famine. They had no storage. They had no distribution network. They didn't have the things that the Agricultural Extension Service was establishing in the United States in the Depression. The farmers are plenty smart. They know what they're doing. Now, in other places, you get better seed or better fertilizer. You can do a lot more. There are lots of examples, including work we've been involved in Rwanda, Malawi, that show that you can do this. But it is not inconsistent with her business to have farmers be able to grow things that people have to consume on site instead of having to bring that in to stay alive. And it is, if she believes that, then maybe, just maybe, we got a chance to get the World Bank and some of these other institutions funded to the point where we can have non-governmental groups that understand about what needs to be done, go out and work with these farmers and have more people feeding each other, and that will solve a big chunk of the hunger problem. There is far more capacity for sustainable agriculture to completely feed the people in poor countries to keep them alive than is being tapped today. And that may be the most important point that anybody will make today. So thank you very much.
Tushak, would you like to react to this a little bit in terms of the balance of agriculture production worldwide and how it's affecting your company, your strategy, maybe with a word also on the green side of things, on the sustainability side?
Okay, well, maybe I'll pick up on the last thing you said and also build on President Clinton's comment about, you know, all this is interconnected, this sustainability, this philanthropy, this social investing, this... We call it sustainability in our company, but created a sustainability steering process and committee. And the three big things that are critical for us, again, longer term, and also that we need to take more urgent action on now, have to do with water, climate change, and the supply chain, which gets into the all the way from the farm through the end product. And to comment on green, if I could, for a moment, just a little bit of context. Some of the crops that are grown around the world, if you think about any of the crops or harvests in some of the most fertile regions of the world, somehow they find their way to your breakfast counter or lunchbox or dinner table through some process, unless you're eating just the vegetables out of your backyard, for example. Out of corn, we produce 24 products from a kernel of corn. Now, some may be more familiar to you than others, like an ethanol or a corn syrup, but it's many of those other different products that also can drive the green. We think about trying to reduce the amount of sweetener that might be in our children's drinks, as you referred to. Well, what would we use that stream for? That stream may go to replace chemicals today that are made from petroleum, but instead come from a bio base like a plastic, a biodegradable plastic, many other industrial chemicals that can be taken from part of this stream that we don't want to waste one little item. There is no waste in the system, so that every single part of the stream of in corn in this case, does not go to waste, but instead goes to some product, including ultimately green energy, whether it's biomass, whether it's advanced fuels related to, you know, ethanol and biodiesel today are the only transportation fuel that is sort of an alternative, that is an alternative to gasoline produced, but the next generation will also be important, and we have several investments along those lines. We talked on the way in about carbon sequestration. Another example of carbon capture and sequestration that's important to the longer term for any major manufacturer, whether they are in food manufacturing or other, is to be able to find a way to take that carbon, and at least the pathway today might be to be able to capture it off of the manufacturing and into store it into the ground longer term. We have one of the largest, I think it is the largest actually, that's in the stage four development in the United States, a joint venture with public-private NGOs. It is with the Department of Energy, Archer Daniels Midland, the Geologic Consortium in the Midwest, to put CO2 under the Illinois Basin in Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky, very large basin under a third capstone, and sequester it for the experts in the geologists believe for 1,000 years without much migration. It'll be a 3-year test to see where that goes, but again, another example of where we think some of this effort in green needs to take it. Maybe one last comment that President Clinton said earlier is you have to have a business case for all of this. And I think the business case or good economics really comes into play if you think enough longer term for what the demand from the customers might be. In our case, because we're not a consumer company, we're not sort of a household name like a Coke would be, we would go to companies and customers like Coke and ask what that longer term strategy is in their mind and be able to back engineer some of these new products, some of these greener products, some of the products that might replace what exists today to be able to match that economic need in the future.
Thank you very much. And I think the coal example, all the examples, but the coal example is particularly important. I mean, there's not going to be a solution to the climate problem without having cleaner coal and without being able to manage the coal problem. And so when you explain to us that you're doing it right now, and that progress is being made, that's extremely encouraging. Mukhtar, could you perhaps tell us a little bit about how all this has affected the spirit in the company, the morale, the internal values, and also what advice do you have for others who are perhaps not quite as far along? In this day where, you know, corporations are again being questioned because of the economic crisis, the problems in the financial sector, the kinds of activities, doing well by doing good, what does it do for the company?
Well, I think, we unless you are able to make it an integral part of your vision, and what we've done is, and you have to do it not, in our case, not just ourselves internally as the Coca-Cola company, because the Coca-Cola company is part of a system. The system is called the Coca-Cola system, and the system comprises of also 300 bottling partners around the world. And with the system, we employ directly 1 million people around the world. Ourselves, we employ about 100,000. But with our system, we employ 1 million. And of course, no one makes a distinction between whether a person in the Coca-Cola system is employed by the company or a bottler in Argentina or a bottler in Switzerland, because everyone wears the Coca-Cola hat, everyone drives a Coca-Cola truck, and everyone wears a Coca-Cola uniform that they see. Therefore, they're all part and parcel of the system. And what we did is get together with our 300 bottling partners and craft a vision for 2020. We call it the 2020 roadmap. And in that vision, one of the key pillars is planet, together with portfolio, together with profit, together with partners, and together with people. But one of those key pillars is planet. And planet is part of the way we think about the business. And that's been the cultural change all the way up and down into the entire company, and also The same is true with our supply chain. You know, we often have meetings with our suppliers to ensure that they are an integral part of that 2020 vision. And in fact, this year, we're holding a supplier sustainability summit. Our key 15, 16 suppliers that make up our supply chain, we get together at the highest level, and we'll do that in a couple of months, so that we can ensure that they play an absolutely critical role in the supply chain, because unless you get it through the supply chain, you can't really make it part of the vision. And I think that is really when it becomes part of your strategy every year and on a long-term basis, then it really becomes embedded into the culture of the company, and it becomes good business. It becomes good business because I'll give you another example. Soon, we will be manufacturing some of our products in what we call BioPET bottles. What are BioPET bottles? BioPET bottles are similar to the bottles that you see here when you look at them, but they are actually made of a blend of PET resin. Part of the resin is still virgin PET that comes from petroleum, is a byproduct. But the other part of the resin is a hybrid that is made from sugarcane extract. And I think those are the kind of initiatives that you can only get done when you believe that they really make business sense. It's not a cost, it's an advantage. And over the next 10 years, single initiative could transform the whole concept of recycling around the world for beverage containers. So it's just one initiative that goes into it. Another one is natural non-nutritive sweeteners. We've been innovating for the last. It's been part of an integral part of our innovation for the last 4 or 5 years to work with again our key supplying partners to ensure that we can develop a non-nutritive natural sweetener, which is now developed, and we launched some of our products with that sweetener now available on the U.S. market. Vitamin Water 10 is an example, some of our Odwalla juices, and now Sprite, one of our main sparkling beverages. And as the supply ramps up, you'll see us applying that innovation to a lot of more products, and back to what President Clinton said in terms of ensuring that a lot of our new products are both low and no calorie, but also naturally sweetened.
Thank you very much, Muhtar. Yes, President Clinton.
I just want to interject one little reality dose here, because we have these two giant companies being run by people who get it. But I think, it's very important, if you listen to all these things they're doing, they can afford to finance and drive this all the way through a supply chain. And I agree with them, it's good business, it raises employee morale, but it also changes the whole brand in the mind of the public. Think what trouble Walmart was in 5 years ago. Right? Everybody said, oh, it's anti-labor, they pay low wages, they don't give health care benefits, they employ illegal immigrants. And so they come out with a health care, they sell $4 prescriptions, they come out with a health care plan that actually is, as far as I can tell, the most progressive one, with one of those health savings accounts, which I don't like, but theirs is good because they give you primary and preventive care with no out-of-pocket cost. And they cut their packaging 5%, and it's like taking 211,000 diesel trucks off the road. Changed their whole brand, and they reported increased profits. Now, this is an economy that's good for them because they're low-cost sellers, but still, it changes the brand. But the thing I want to talk about is we have to change a lot of our delivery systems for the smaller companies to access this, and for NGOs. Basically, what the president's leading us through now in the Treasury Department, we're going through a wrenching, changing the delivery system and finance. And it's going to be more transparent, And we're going to have more sensible risk assessment, thank goodness. And so I predict that when we come out on the other side of this, we'll have more old-fashioned finance with more modern products and services. We're going to do a healthcare reform. I've been schooled on this by my daughter, who's now studying in the School of Public Health at Columbia, but she gave me a paper the other day which said that, yeah, Medicare is in terrible trouble, but over the next 25 years, 80% of the cost increase is not going to be all of us baby boomers retiring. That's 20%. 80% is applying to that extra 20% the cost curve in healthcare. It's inflation caused the delivery system is not sustainable. And the same thing is true in energy. So one of the things that, Kamal, we need a lot of thought about is, and one of the things that I hope we can do more at the Global Initiative, because we're trying to this year really focus on the processes by which you reduce poverty or increase education or healthcare or fight climate change, is how you access this if you're not as big as Coke or ADM. For example, people tell me all the time, well, there's only so much you can do with solar and wind and conservation. Bull, you can do more with conservation than anything else, and you get more jobs out of it. For every $1 billion you spend on a coal-fired power plant, you create 870 jobs. For solar, depending on whether it's photovoltaics or solar thermal, just under 2,000 jobs per billion. For wind, if you make it all, if you make the windmills and assemble them in the country and put them up, 3,300 jobs. For building retrofits, 6,000 jobs. The United States ranks about 100th in energy efficiency in the world. It's a bird's nest on the ground. Why don't we do it? Because the financing favors highly centralized construction. If he cut his water usage 20% in a year, it's just like he goes out and drills wells and finds water and pumps them up. Now, the tax treatments there are not as disparate as they are for these other things. And if you can't do it that way, you have to do something for the end user, the consumer. That's why I really hope that this automobile trauma that's going through has a positive outcome, but I was encouraged to see that the government is apparently going to offer a big incentive for people to turn in their old clunkers. Somebody needs to be thinking about how we're going to have a much bigger recycling industry and what's going to happen there, because it's much cheaper to produce recycled steel and aluminum than it is to make it from the get-go, and less energy intensive. But there's lots of things like that we need to think about. We're greening the Empire State Building. My foundation's working on that in New York. We're going to cut their emissions by 38%. They're going to get a LEEDs rating, a LEEDs Gold rating, a Depression era Art Deco building, 6,500 new windows, all going to be assembled and put in, you know, on site. We're going to actually do a lot of the manufacturing work on site. But the point is, it's only possible because it's a big building and the guy that owns the building can self-finance it. And it's got a 7.5-year payout as opposed to a 20-year payout on a coal-fired power plant. One of my partners, technical partner in Sweden, that helps us convert landfills. We ought to close every landfill in every big city in the world. It's an energy source. It's a gold mine. It's got a state-of-the-art facility, and no landfill in Gothenburg, Sweden. It's a great town in northern Sweden, 500,000 people. Their utility bills are $35 million a year less because they create electricity from their landfill. But it took them 17 years to pay it off. Why? Because they treated it as if they were building a coal-fired power plant, which would have taken them 3 years longer to pay off, not less. But most cities that want to do this can't work the financing because they don't have the same access. So I'd like to see those of you who care about all this stuff think about delivery systems and how we have parallel financing systems so companies not as big as Coke and ADM can access the same flow of history. Our companies that are in trouble, like the automobile companies, can have somebody come around and figure out how. I mean, why shouldn't the federal government retire all of its fleet early? Create a market for these auto companies. Why doesn't the Defense Department get rid of all their fleet? I mean, we need to think about the financing disabilities of these transformations we need to make as a delivery system problem, because it's a horrible problem if you're not big enough to do a lot of this on your own.
Thank you very much. Lots to think about, and I do believe perhaps the incentives in the financial sector, if they were a little more long-term, that would be part of the solution, perhaps. But let's turn to the audience. We don't have much time. In fact, we have very little time, but maybe two or three questions, and then President Clinton and our guests have to leave. Yes. Right there.
Okay, thank you. This is a question for President Clinton. As one follows the climate change debate in the Congress that's happening, is there not a disconnect in the following sense? Much of the climate debate, as it has played out in this country, is perceived by the consuming public as an application of pain and suffering through higher utility bills, higher gasoline costs, and benefits that are abstract in nature or very, very long term. And yet, the reality is that many of the benefits of climate change controls, greenhouse gas controls, are much more immediate than that. Is there not a need to reframe this climate change debate, and how would you rearticulate it?
President Clinton, with your permission, could I just maybe ask one more question so that we collect, if there are, of course. Yes, behind there, one more, and then we'll, yeah.
Yes, hi, I'm Ron Layton from Light Years IP, and I wish to ask a question to the two corporates here. You may know, and President Clinton knows very well, that poverty and environmental degradation go together. And because Ethiopia's coffee farmers are among the very poorest, most successful coffee farmers and exporters in the world, unfortunately, Ethiopia has to take on a very nasty and now highly unsuccessful flour industry. It's damaging the country, and it's actually losing money in the recessed conditions. So we came to a corporate like you folks about 3 years ago and said, could you actually look at the Ethiopian case for doing exactly what you do, which is manage our supply chain and license our distributors in this country? The big corporation, Starbucks, fought tooth and nail. All the big corporations like yourselves fought tooth and nail, and Ethiopia had to really, really struggle to get that situation to change. That was the first Starbucks. The second Starbucks agreed and said, we can change our business model. We can allow you to earn more out of the very successful export that you have. So Ethiopia went up from 100 million out of 2,000 million to 200 million out of 2,000 million. And Starbucks did very well. So we're coming to you both with different clients now in Africa in a similar situation. How will you react to holding on to your business model, or can you adjust to this kind of approach?
All right. I think we're running out of time, but President Clinton, you first.
Well, first of all, I would sell this as the greatest economic opportunity that America's had since we got out of the Depression by mobilizing for World War II, and we don't have to kill anybody to do it this time. In fact, we're going to save the planet for our grandchildren. And what I would do is adjust the financing mechanisms so that, look, if you put a price on carbon today and you start paying it tomorrow and you don't realize the savings from clean energy or alternative energy for 10 years, then you are, if you do it in that stark way, you will have a short-term reduction in GDP and a long-term gain, and a lot of people won't be around in the long term, and it's hard to sell now because people's incomes are down. So what we need to do is to work the financing so you share the savings immediately. One of the things that I think should come out of this energy debate is there should be a federal mandate for decoupling in this country. Otherwise, we're going to have to go raise the financing for all this energy efficiency. If a utility could make just as much money financing the energy efficiency of the Empire State Building and all the other buildings in Manhattan as it could building another power plant, then they could share the savings immediately. That's what I was going to do on my own with public buildings before the banking collapse. That is, I had a deal with the energy service organizations to guarantee savings and then banks to loan money longer term to public entities and take repayment only from the utility savings. So there'd be no out-of-pocket cost, and under certain circumstances, to share them. Since utilities can finance over 20 years if you had decoupling, They could say, let's say they come to your home and they cut your energy use 30%. They could give you a 15% reduction in power bills right away, take the other 15% for 20 years and cover the loan as if they built a mini coal-fired power plant and put one hell of a lot more people to work. That's what I'm telling you. We got to focus on the delivery systems to make sure we do this and sequence it right. I want the Congress to pass a strong bill. I think we got to put a price on carbon, but how we do it will determine whether we can start from the get-go making money out of it. I think it can be the salvation of Detroit if we do it right. I think that there are lots of opportunities here, but more focus needs to be on how we're going to do it than how much money we're going to spend on it. We need to figure out how to make it good business, and people like you need to help. We got to, but I would sell it. I think it is, I wake up every morning happy about it. I've got a friend in California that just built the world's first carbon positive airplane hangar. It'll take all business jets and small commercial planes. It produces 110% as much energy as it uses at full utilization and saves all the plane owners $1,500 a day in jet fuel because they don't have to turn the engines on to check their instruments. And it produces so much energy that it actually provides all the utilities for 19 homes in the neighborhood. And it was built for $30 a square foot less than an airplane hangar of exactly the same size next to it. So that's what we got to talk about. We've got to stop all this Chicken Little talk and get the show on the road and look at talk about the positive stuff.
Patricia and Mukhtar, maybe let's just see whether there are one or two more questions. Yes, Noam. And then you can take the other one and all together.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
My question has to do with reducing poverty and increasing economic growth in developing countries. And earlier in the discussion, there was mention of the role that government can play in facilitating partnerships with business. And so my question is, from the perspective of donor governments that really drive trade policy and development assistance policies, and from the perspective of developing countries, what are some examples of things that those governments could be doing to encourage the kind of partnerships that really work for poverty reduction and economic growth?
Okay, yes, one last one. This will be the last question, yeah.
Hi, I want to just piggyback on that and focus on reducing poverty here in the United States. And thinking about maybe applying some of this creative thinking about the distribution system and the role of business, excuse me. We have in the U.S. workforce about 80 million people who are employed who have deficiencies in their skills. We have a distribution system for adult education that doesn't really connect to the realities of employers and employees. So employers invest about $110 billion in training, but usually for people who are already pretty highly skilled. So how can business work more effectively with a distribution system of adult training to address the skills gap of current employees in order to create a more highly productive incumbent workforce, and also to build a much more productive pipeline of workers and focus on the poverty issue within the U.S.?
Okay. Patricia?
Well, maybe I'll...
Questions and any last word.
Okay, I'll start a little bit with the end and maybe work around a bit. I think your question's a good one. Often when we talk about poverty or areas with focus, we forget about our U.S. and talk about all the severe issues outside of the U.S. And I think education happens to be a focus area for our ADM CARES program within communities. One area that addresses your question directly is the JAG program, the Jobs for American Graduates, that I think employers can very much be a part of within communities for the less skilled, even those that are not graduating high school. The data is very clear that particularly in communities that have low graduation rates, the employment follows from that it is not there. The companies working with those schools, working with those local communities, can make a huge difference. And I think it is does need to be communities within which we work and live, as opposed to the broad spectrum, because that's where you get the local volunteers, you get the commitment to the funding as well. To get back to a couple of the other questions related to fair trade, as well as what can governments do, I think these partnership opportunities with private sector, governments, NGOs need to focus, in my view, on the one or two areas that can truly make a difference in the long term in bringing the right partnerships together. So it's the right companies, the right NGOs, to find that common ground. Sometimes there's not common ground when you bring an issue to a company, but I believe, generally speaking, there is common ground if you want to continue to do business, whether it's selling into, exporting, building infrastructure. If you want to do business, you have to have the right to permit come from that community. So you will find common ground if you search for it. So keep going back and looking for it, because I think governments have the best opportunity to say where that common ground exists and that focus for that particular country or community.
Thank you, Patricia. Mukhtar?
Just very quickly, let me give you one example that addresses the issue of business model, flexibility, reduction of poverty, social empowerment, and economic empowerment. We employ, we're the largest employer in Africa, in the continent of Africa. Our Africa Foundation created a concept called Manual Distribution Center. It's now employed in 14 different countries in Africa. What it does is, our business model calls for us to distribute our products with our own trucks to the end customer, which then the consumers come and buy our products from there. What we found in Africa is that we should change our model, be more flexible, and create individual entrepreneurs that can take our products to smaller villages. We now have 2,500 of these manual distribution centers in Africa. They employ 11,000 people, and we have created 2,500 entrepreneurs in 14 countries. The key here is, we train them in basic accounting, we train them in hygiene, we train them in basic marketing skills. The Harvard Kennedy School just completed a study on the manual distribution centers 2.5 months ago, and said that this is a great opportunity, and we should continue with the IFC, International Finance Corporation, and they have given their total backing. And one other thing we've found in here is that most of the time we get better cooperation from small city governments, municipalities, mayors, than the federal government. And that's been a great learning for us. So we may not get the ear of the federal government, but we sure as hell get the ear of the mayor or the head of the village or the governor. And that really works very well. We are now, in the next 2 years, going to set up another 2,000 of these, employing, that will create an employment for an additional 8,500 people. And so we've changed our business model, been more flexible, we're working with governments, working with local governments most of the time. And the next phase, the second phase, another thing we're doing, which came out of the study from the Harvard Kennedy School, is this is a great opportunity in Africa to empower women. So what we've said is that half of the new MDCs, manual distribution centers, are going to be women entrepreneurs. So that's another, again, social empowerment, which is critical, because what this does is changes the awareness and creates the notion that people can help themselves. You've got to help people to help themselves to win in this game of eradicating poverty. And it is a great business for us, because our products get distributed to the villages at the same time, at the best cost and in the most effective way.
Thank you very much. President Clinton, one last word.
On the international front, let me just say, first of all, we need more money for assistance. The American people will support this. They believe we give 10 to 15% of our revenues in foreign aid, and it's more like 1%. They think we ought to give 3 to 5. The Secretary of State, with support of the President, asked for a doubling of foreign assistance. Be the best money we ever spent. Secondly, we got to spend it right. Too much of American foreign aid never leaves our shores. There needs to be a total deconstruction of this. Hillary and I went out for a walk the other day. We were going to Strobe's house. And on the way there and on the way back, we met two women, one in her 20s, one in her 40s, who worked for international health NGOs. And they working in Washington, D.C. instead of someplace else. Why? They got to hustle the money. They got to write reports. They want to do analysis. It's ridiculous. And it's not just America. We should put 80% of the money that Congress appropriates. That ought to be our goal for foreign assistance in the countries. Then we ought to focus, I agree with what has just been said, on empowerment. We gave 2 million microcredit loans a year when I was president. That's enough to change the life of a lot of villages. Not enough to change many countries. Bangladesh, as if you, those of you who know it, is always trouble with these huge factional political fighting with the two women who had the big political groups who were, one lost her husband, one lost her father at the political assassination. And unfortunately, they virtually grind the country's politics to a halt from time to time. And all this grinding before the current collapse, the Bangladeshi economy is growing at 6% a year anyway. Why? Because they have the thickest, oldest network of microcredit empowering people at the grassroots level. So we can do it. The second thing I would say, to echo what's already been said, if you put all the women, all the girls in school and give all the women access to the labor market, you would slow population growth and increase GDP in a more balanced way on every, in every continent on Earth. The third thing is poor people should be part of the energy revolution. One of our CGI partners has electrified an Ethiopian village where I visited. Every little hut's got a tiny little solar reflector, enough to run a TV at night or keep the lights on to study. And they've got one school building, only one, that the people in the village picked how they wanted it lit. There are four corners of this schoolroom. Two of them are lit with compact fluorescent bulbs. The other two have LED lighting. Why? Because the women can go in and work at night in the diffuse light of the compact fluorescent bulbs, and the kids can go in and study and read at night in the concentrated light from the LED bulbs. Don't patronize poor people. They'll do just fine. And the final thing is, to go back to what Patricia said, I just think it's so important. We've got to get the show on the road on taking self-sustainable agriculture up to scale. We had this notion that because Brazil and Argentina had 22 feet of topsoil and America was productive and Europe was productive and the Green Revolution was in order, that we just didn't have to help poor people everywhere farm. It just was wrong that they could somehow skip that stage of economic development. Now, in America, you ask about America. I started something when I was president called the School to Work Transition, and we really tried to organize all the private sector people who were interested in it to get everybody into at least 2 years of some kind of post-high school training shaped by the demands of the economy, driven by the employers. And it kind of fell off. We need to go back to that. And we need to make it more affordable and accessible, including college. The Pell Grant covered 74% of the cost of a year of college in 1970, covers about 35% today. And again, the delivery system's not sustainable. I had the biggest increase in college aid since the GI Bill, and the gains were gone in 5 years. It was as if I had never done anything in terms of the pocketbook impact. So all of you who, Bill Galston's out here nodding his head, all of you who are involved in higher education, we're going to have to change the delivery system. This is not sustainable any more than healthcare is. The third thing I would say is we're bringing, the Grameen Bank is about to open a branch in the United States, in New York City, and other places. We had the first federal funds for domestic microcredit. Hillary and I raised the money 25 years ago for the first rural microcredit bank in America. And it's still going. We need to do more of that here. And then let me just give you some really mundane stuff. This year in New York City, over 100,000 people who were eligible for the earned income tax credit did not claim it. I get every tax cut I'm entitled to. And I don't even have to think about it, right? Pay the accountant. Guys rich as me, they just practically throw your tax credits and deductions at you. The EITC, the most important tax break in the entire tax code, is the hardest to get. It is not user-friendly. So we either ought to have employers and others helping people get it as we lobbied to Congress to make it more user-friendly. And finally, we're talking about hunger, which is the flip side of childhood obesity in America, the same group of people. It just depends on what line, what side of the survival line you're on. The president, in his stimulus package, extended food stamp benefits. I thought it was a wonderful thing to do. 65% of the food stamp benefits are claimed. 35% are not claimed, even in this terrible economy. And what's really unbelievable is it's drastic variations by state. Some states, only 50% of the eligible food stamp dollars are claimed. In other states, it's over 90. So if you're an interested citizen, if you're an NGO person, if you're an employer, we ought to figure out what to do about that. It is a horrible problem. You want to do something about poverty in America? With the food banks going broke, get the food stamp claiming up above 90% everywhere.
Thank you very much, President Clinton, Patricia Wirtz, Mukhtar Kent. You not only shared your enthusiasm, but you gave us very concrete examples of what can be done, what you are doing already, but you also underlined the huge challenges ahead. So thank you very much for doing this, and thanks to all of you for joining us.